What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Yuri Degaya is a partner at BTC Reserve HQ, a premier Bitcoin brokerage, founder at Liquidity HQ, host of the Citadelium podcast, and author of many notable pieces, including the sensational essay, Bitcoin as a Tool for Succession, published in Citadel 21, Volume 4. He is a Bitcoiner and a builder of Citadels. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, Yuri. How are you?
Thank you, Cedric, for inviting me. I'm doing really well.
Oh, great. That's great to hear. You know, before we kind of get into, you know, a lot of your writing and more about who you are, let's just kind of get some background on what is, you know, BTC Reserve and Liquidity.
Sure. I started in Bitcoin about 2012, late 2012, and my kind of first passion and my first occupation, so to speak, in Bitcoin was brokerage. So I've gone through a multiple iterations of that business, and I ended up founding a company called L2B Global, which is now rebranded as of January 2020, Bitcoin Reserve. So Bitcoin Reserve is essentially a Bitcoin brokerage firm that allows users, namely European Union clients, to buy and sell Bitcoin with us. We're a Bitcoin-only company. We don't do anything else besides Bitcoin, although we do support some stable coins, because for us, it's simply just another means of receiving and sending fiat, right? Like US dollars, right, or euros. Yeah. And I'm also interested in other Bitcoin technologies. As you know, Bitcoin, the main chain, the main layer of Bitcoin is quite limited in what it can do, which is a good and a bad thing in terms of a user experience, but a good thing in terms of security of the Bitcoin network. So people are starting to invent new ways of moving money around, and they are coming up with a so-called layer two technologies, and Liquid, the Liquid network, is a sidechain technology that is essentially an upgrade to the Bitcoin network. It's a federated sidechain that can do things that the main chain cannot really do. And Liquidity is a tool that allows you to move Bitcoin to the Liquid network and out of the Liquid network, as well as exchange some assets that can be issued on the Liquid network. So that's the short rundown.
Sure. What kind of activity do you see on the Liquid network?
Well, essentially, Liquid network is designed to do a few things. The first thing is to send and receive Bitcoin faster than on-chain, because the Liquid network doesn't really have miners. So it's a federated sidechain, right? So it's a federation of businesses around the world that are independent, but work together to essentially process transactions. So the block time on the Liquid network is only 1 minute, as opposed to 10 minutes on average on the Bitcoin blockchain. So that allows you to move Bitcoin literally in 1 minute, and it's not variable. It's always 1 minute. It cannot be like 1.5 sometimes, and sometimes 30 seconds, like on the Bitcoin network. So you're always sure. And another advantage is that if you know anything about Bitcoin, you know that the Bitcoin blockchain is a public thing, right? So you can see the movement of money from one address to another, and you can also see the amounts that are moved. On the Liquid network, the amounts that are moved are hidden by default. They are called confidential transactions. And that allows for a certain degree of privacy to people who trade large amounts or move large amounts of money around. For example, if you're a large trader, you want to move money from one exchange to another, say from Bitfinex to BitC, you would use you would move Bitcoin on the Liquid network instead of the main chain, and you will gain by that action, you will gain two advantages. First one is your move will be very fast, within literally a couple of minutes. And the second is that the third-party observers who usually observe the Bitcoin network, they will not be able to tell how much money you moved and what kind of asset you moved, right? So that gives a big advantage to you. It's kind of a famous thing on the Bitcoin network that there are all kinds of Twitter bots out there who who notify everybody else. One of those bots is called the Whale Alert. And it literally every time someone moves a more or less significant amount of money, the Whale Alert bot notifies everybody on Twitter, okay, this user moved this much money from Bitfinex to this exchange. Right. And, you know, if you're more dedicated, in terms of snooping around, you can actually figure out more details about the user, right? Like the IP address, location, what all kinds of things, which is a hindrance to privacy. So Liquid Network really helps with that regard, and not to speak about issued assets. You can issue all kinds of assets on the Liquid Network natively, unlike some other blockchains where you have to create all kinds of complicated things like smart contracts. On the Liquid Network, you just do it literally with one command, and it's issued natively, and it's super easy to do. Which is not always good in terms of because it's also kind of an open network, right? Anybody can use it, and obviously we've seen lots of scams on the on other networks, such as ERC20 scams. People literally, the saying goes, if you give a person an ability to print money, he will print money. And a lot of people have done that in the past. So Liquid kind of allows to do that thing as well, but more natively. Just because something is issued on Liquid, that's kind of my warning to everybody else. Just because it's issued on Liquid, just because Blockstream is involved, and just because it's a Bitcoin sidechain, does not mean that there will be no nefarious actors out there. So take care.
Yeah, everyone's a scammer. I'm really excited about those technologies. I wasn't trying to infer anything scammy about those technologies, but definitely, do your own research and try to understand what you're using. I really want to start digging into, just from the beginning of your work. Because I think you've been very transparent, very honest, and really, a truth seeker. And the first one I want to touch off on is a piece, how to deal with imposter syndrome, and what do you do if you feel out of place and sort of uneasy about your maybe favorable circumstances, or you feel unworthy? How does someone deal with that?
Yeah. I think it's, you read the article, I guess. It just comes from personal experience, right? I always had this feeling that, I'm probably not in the right place because all these people have, succeeded at something. They are so successful, and here I am. And that's pretty much what the imposter syndrome is. It kind of tells you, there's a voice in your head that tells you that you're not worthy of being where you are and what you have achieved. And I think the best way to fight it is just to, first of all, understand that such a thing exists, right? And then accept it for what it is. And then if you study some of the Stoic philosophers out there, I think it really helps because it allows you to adopt a new view of the world, a new view on life itself, right? It just kind of tells you, accept the world for what it is, accept things for what they are, and you'll have only control over the things that are in your immediate control, and you cannot really stress about things that are outside of your control. So that's the basics of the Stoic philosophy, and I think the main thing here is to really start viewing yourself from like a third person, and basically evaluating where you are and what you have done, and maybe even comparing yourself to others from that point of view, because that allows you a glimpse of where you are. Because if you look at yourself this way, you kind of see that, I'm already at this stage of development, and there's so many people out there on Earth, almost 8 billion people, and I'm really, really not where they are. I'm really probably, I don't want to say higher than they are, but more developed in terms of certain things, right? And that's not a bad thing, because I actually put some work into this, right? I'm not here because I ended up here by chance. I actually did some work to gain this. This is my proof of work. Mm-hmm. And if you recognize your proof of work, you recognize that you actually deserve where you are, and you deserve your position. But you also have to keep in mind that there's also an unlimited way up or forward, right? there's unlimited amount of development that you can still do, and that just because you find yourself where you are does not limit you. You still have a way to go, and most likely you'll just keep developing and building your inner and outer world until the rest of your life. That's how life is, I believe that a person who stops developing at a certain point is pretty much dead, right? Because only death can stop you from developing. Other than that, there's an unlimited amount of directions that you can take, things you can learn, and ways you can develop yourself.
Yeah, I think that's something I really love about your work, that sort of that internal exploration, that internal and external exploration that I think you've been very honest about through your writings. And I, the two pieces I linked together there is sort of the imposter syndrome and how to deal with, like, I don't feel I'm worthy. And then kind of like, well, maybe I do feel I'm worthy. And where is this going? And what can I imagine, what can I kind of think about internally about the external world? So like, what is like, would I be ready to be a billionaire, mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be a billionaire? And what do you think it means, to be a billionaire? What is that really about?
Yeah, because I did have conversations with some of my friends about that. And obviously, a lot of people who think about money, they are thinking big, right? They want, okay, I want to become a millionaire, or even bigger, I want to become a billionaire. I've heard some of my friends tell me that directly. And I started thinking about it because to me, it was, okay, what do you mean by I want to be a billionaire? What does $1 billion give you that you don't have right now, right? Is it a bigger yacht, or is it a bigger apartment? Or, okay, now you have a big house. Now you have a big yacht. Now you have a trophy wife. what are you gonna do next? Is there a stop? And what I realized is that there is basically no stop to material things. If you, there is no stop. As soon as you acquire one, you will need the other, another one, right? A better one. Or as I like to think about it, not a better one, because better ones don't exist, a different one, right? And there's an unlimited amount of different ones out there. So you will never be satisfied if you're after material possessions. And that's exactly why I think a lot of people who dream about being a billionaire, they don't really realize what they want to be to get. But at the same time, this amount of money, this amount of material possessions, bring lots of problems into your life as well. Because if you heard this evaluation of life, I guess they say that the poorest people who live, in some Asian countries, who are like the fishermen, who live in very, very poor villages, are the happiest people in the world, because they simply have no possessions. They just enjoy their life. They go out in the sea and they fish, and they enjoy the freedom of everyday, simplicity, essentially. And that got me thinking too. And I understood that all these material possessions, they bring a lot of problems. Some people say that rich people don't have problems. They do have problems, and they actually have more problems, and they are just different problems. Yes, of course, they don't have the problem of putting food on their table. They have plenty of food. But with that, they have other problems, like, a bunch of friends you haven't talked to who appear in your life and suddenly want to be friends again. A bunch of family members, a bunch of people who simply want your money, right? There's all kinds of trouble just because you have more money, right? Or just because you are visible in terms of, in terms of where you are in your monetary wealth. I think people have to reevaluate that. And when they think about being a billionaire, I'm not saying that being a billionaire is bad. I'm just saying that if you are a billionaire, what are you going to do with your wealth? Is it just for material pleasures and material possessions? Or are you going to really do something? Because I think you can do lots of amazing things with billions of dollars, right? Like when I start thinking about it, all I want to do with my capital is apply it to build something, to make something happen. And Most likely, like I have done in the past, I will fail many, many times, but there will be probably some thing or a few things that will actually succeed. And it will be amazing to see that I created something that people love and people need and that makes people's lives better. So I think that's what it's really about. It's not really about just, sending a message to everybody else about your status and just saying, I'm a billionaire and you're not.
Yeah, I think those are sharp words. You know, speaking of tools, you know, money's a tool. And like you said, if money's a tool, then like with a hammer, you can build with it or you can crush and destroy things with it. I mean, give a hammer to a 2-year-old and they're not going to build much. But it is kind of a good experiment to give a hammer to a 2-year-old and let them destroy some things and see what their power is. Exactly. And, you know, like CK Snarks always says, you know, iron sharpens iron. So, you know, how do you think Bitcoin makes, people better?
Yeah, I think the main concept here that was popularized by Saifedean Ammous is low time preference. And I think that's what Bitcoin does exactly. And it may not seem significant to someone who just comes across this concept for the first time, but I think this is a life-changing concept. It's pretty much what everything hinges upon in the world. It's if you don't know yet that low time preference or just the time preference, the concept of time preference comes from economics, and just it's about you wanting to either do something or forego something and do it in the future at with a better result, I guess. The famous experiment, the marshmallow experiment with kids, shows time preference really, really well. When kids were given marshmallows and said, okay, you can get this marshmallow right now, or if you don't eat it right now, in half an hour, we'll give you 2 marshmallows, right? And that, that kind of showed how many kids had the self-control to wait for half an hour, or how many of them ate it, right? That's what time preference is about. And Bitcoin does it naturally because it has this number go up technology, so-called, baked into the protocol. It pretty much is designed to pump forever. I'm not here to actually pump Bitcoin. I'm just stating the fact. I'm just stating what people don't understand, because a lot of people in Bitcoin, they still think that it's just an investment. It's not an investment. It's literally a reinvention of money. And it's the first time that a money was invented with a completely limited supply. And that limited supply combined with other advantages of Bitcoin, it gives it lots and lots of ways to go. And I think that Bitcoin will be pumping forever, pretty much. And when it destroys the fiat currency, it will start devouring all the other assets that are really not essential. When someone understands that, their brain changes a little bit. The way they think changes a little bit. And if right now you wanted to, spend $100 on a party and spend it on some beers, you will think, okay, well, these $100 and all these beers may cost $1,000 a year from now, or $10,000 a couple of years from now. So do I really want to do it? And a lot of people don't do it anymore, right? They stop doing what they were doing before. They change their habits. Literally, they change their habits. And if you zoom out a little bit, if you think about it a little bit deeper on a philosophical level, you can come to conclusions like this is exactly how civilizations are built, right? People save. People think about the future. They don't live in the present. And I'm not talking about the present moment. I love living in the present moment, as in enjoying the present moment, but not the type of present moment where you burn your life because whatever, it can end tomorrow, right? No, you start thinking about the future and you invest in the future. You enjoy the present moment as is, and you don't try to kind of go about life in the fashion that doesn't really care about the future. So things like family, things like legacy, things like building to last, things like culture, All of that comes from low time preference, and it's been, I think, through history, it's been shown over and over again that as soon as people start living a high time preference life, that means, you know, debauchery and all kinds of stuff. Their civilization collapses, culture collapses, and unfortunately, this is what we are seeing right now in 2020, and in probably next year we'll see a lot of that too. And we'll see where it goes. I think Bitcoin is the light at the end of the tunnel that actually allows us to go back to low time preference, and the more people jump on the bandwagon, the better. I don't think a lot of people will actually buy into the building civilization argument. They will probably just go for the number go up technology, and just, you know, the simple I want to get rich argument, which is fine. That's what the masses do, and I'm completely fine with that.
Yeah, let's go bigger than the number go up technology though. Sure. And let's get into some of that rebuilding civilization. And I think that's now, and I think the way you summarize that, your quote, when the mind is liberated from the daily worry of impending financial ruin, it attains the capacity for clearer, nobler thinking, unlimited potential previously locked away by fear of material suffering becomes available. And I think that explains generation Bitcoin and what it's about and where we are. And, you know, I think we are going into these kind of two economies. And another one you kind of, another tweet you had that I really kind of I think sums it up well is world perception is subjective. Indeed, 8 billion people live in 8 billion different realities, but the truth is absolutely objective. It is one and final. There cannot be two. Your job is to dismantle as much of the subjectivity as you can and embrace objective reality. And I think some of your work is really kind of trying to get at reality and truth, and you kind of go at the age old problem of how do you scam the planet? How would you go about it if you wanted to be a scammer, and you wanted to scam at a level that you know, just normal people wouldn't comprehend? You know, what would be the keys to scamming the planet?
I guess when you look at my work, you would see some esoteric parts in it. Obviously, you know, there's it's not just a simple digestion of economics and philosophy and stuff like that. There's a little bit of that too. I'm not talking about some new age stuff. I think I like to go deeper, right? Because everything comes from somewhere. What I think is that there's two types of the human composition, I would say, right? Actually, there's seven, but let's focus on the two that are the black and white of our world, right? The materiality and the spirituality, the spiritual life and the material life. The spiritual life is the one that's within you, and the material life is the one that's without. It also has to do with your body and with your bodily senses, right? You can touch things, you can see things, you can smell things. When you go into all kinds of religious texts and sacred texts and spiritual texts, even modern ones, it doesn't really matter. They all kind of talk about the same thing, that, you know, the human being is a spiritual being whose spiritual part is kind of asleep, right? And whose material part is more awake right now. You're essentially immersed in this material world, and you are a little bit blind to what you really are. So when we talk about the masses, when we talk about the population of the planet, the vast majority of people, they are in that state of catatonic sleep, right? They are in that state of material sleep, and they only operate through the senses, through the body, right? Their so-called third eye, the spiritual vision, is a little bit closed, it's dim, right? And when you operate on material only on this material plane, you are, I'm not really afraid of that word, but you are not a lot better than just a regular animal, right? And that's how animals operate. And, you know, the famous Pavlov experiment with the dog and the bell, when, you know, Pavlov trained the dog to salivate upon the ringing the bell, is applicable to humans. There have been many experiments in psychology. There have been this, I don't remember who produced the video, but there was a video about, you know, a Christmas present. Someone brought a lady into a supermarket and said, okay, we are going to pick a present, whatever, for your child, right? And we're going to predict exactly what you're going to pick. And, you know, she ended up picking up some kind of a toy. She even named the toy a certain name. And then they told her that they wrote it down or something. And she was really surprised how they knew beforehand what toy she would pick and how she would name the toy, right? And they told, and they walked her through the store, and they showed her all the subliminal messages sprayed around the store, like, you know, the same toy, the advertisements of the toy, even the advertisements of the name of the toy, all kinds of things that affect her sensual perceptions, like, you know, the eyes, the touch, because they told her to touch some things, they told her to smell some things even, right? And essentially, she was like a dog who was made to salivate with a bell, right? Does that make her an animal? Pretty much, right? So she was just trained to do a certain thing, and she did it. So I think that a lot of people actually go through life in a similar manner that, like, mm-hmm. animals, and there are people out there, you know, not just psychologists, but other people out there who are aware of this. And, you know, marketing people are just one part of those people, but there are many other people who are aware of this, and they use this against, you know, others, right? They use this against others. Like Jordan Belfort is a great example, right? With his subliminal messaging, with his neuro-linguistic programming, and just the way he talks, it's all the same thing. It's just affecting someone's perception, someone's minds with different techniques. Actually, in the past, it was pretty much called black magic. So there are people who are aware of this, and these are the people who are able to scam the planet, right? They are able to, if you are able to manipulate the masses through all kinds of material perceptions, then you can do pretty much whatever you want. This is how a lot of people are getting scammed into all kinds of things, and, you know, this is how consumerism was born, because it's all advertisement, it's all sensual material stuff, right? It's all based on that stuff. You can see subliminal messages absolutely anywhere you go, on TV, on, you know, on streaming services. You can see advertisements, you can see infomercials, you can see audio programming everywhere, and a lot of people don't understand it. They just listen to it and they just enjoy it as a regular program, but it's not. It's supposed to make them do certain things. And of course, right now they are developing, they are getting better and better at it, you know, with Google search optimization, so-called, with search recommendations, video recommendations, and all kinds of things. Because now we all have a tracking device in our pocket that knows exactly what we do, who we talk to, how we talk, what we like, what we don't like. You know, you can talk about buying a dog, and 5 minutes later you get an advertisement for dogs and pet stores and things like that, right? So all of this has a root in it, right? It comes from somewhere. It's not a coincidence. You scam a planet by taking advantage of humans' physical material passions. That's how you do it. I wrote articles about it. I wrote more about, you know, how you scam people into believing that, you know, Their money is good, that their, you know, the political system is good, such as democracy and things like that. But I think that it all boils down to spirituality versus materialism. And we are now really, really lacking in spirituality. But I also think that we are at a turning point. And actually, Bitcoin may help with that, because by lowering time preference, you will have more time to think about not just the future, but also about your own, you know, your own self, where you are, your own inner world. And you can have more time and more effort, to, you know, to just plunge into yourself and think about developing that that world, which is a lot bigger than the material world, I think.
Sure. If you wanted to steer large populations of people, would, you know, you be able to use, you know, something like democracy to do so?
Yeah, no, not really. I don't think so, because democracy democracy has a lot of issues in it. I think what I understand under democracy is more more in terms of what Plato understood under it, right? And it's more like a republic rather than democracy. I used to describe myself as an anarchist, and, you know, anarchy is more of a negatively viewed terms right now. But it's not really that. It's anarchy, I think, is more about economics rather than, you know, going out and blowing up things. those are definitely anarchists in the bad light. What I think is that everything in the social sphere is predicated upon one and single important right, human right, and that is the right to private property. So besides that, no right really matters, because the right to private property pretty much defines all the other rights that you have out there. And it's very easy to illustrate it, for example, with the right to, you know, freedom of speech. But what is freedom of speech, right? When you come to my house, I can actually tell you what you can and cannot speak about, because that's my house. You are on my property. So where exactly can you have freedom of speech? Well, the only absolute freedom of speech I'm talking about, right? You can only have absolute freedom of speech in a so-called public place, a place that apparently does not belong to anyone, right? It's basically, you know, your park, it's the street, it's the bench somewhere on the beach. That's where you have the right to absolute free speech. But as a matter of fact, the right to free speech stems from the right to private property, because it is the owner of the private property who decides what you can and cannot do there, right? And then we basically go through this mental exercises of private property and arrive at a position where in which we believe that private property is the is a lot better than public property, simply because private property owners they care about their property a lot more than some mythical entity called government, right? Because when you say this is government property, what does it mean? Who is the government, right? There is no particular person you can point to. Is that the president? Well, no, president is just a representative of the government. He's just the face of the government. Well, then is that the Congress? Is that, you know, another Duma like in Russia? No, any government consists of a particular set of people, right? So, essentially, that boils down to this problem called the tragedy of the commons, right? Where if a place is not really owned by anybody, it's not going to be taken care of properly, and that's how we see lots of bad stuff happening with the nature as well, with just violations of property and things like that. Like an example with a river. You go, you have a few villages that enjoy a river, and they decided not to claim any part of the river. So because the river doesn't belong to anybody, they just decide to Each village will decide to deplete the river as much as possible to stock up on the fish, right? And suddenly the river becomes depleted. But if each village claims a part of the river, then they will take care to not deplete that part of the river. They want fish there. They want it all the time. They don't want to just, you know, go fishing once and then take all the fish. So they will start taking care of things like, you know, reproducing fish and conserving fish and doing things like that. So that's what I'm talking about. So all of this brings us to things like republics and monarchies, because in those cases, the people who are essentially the ruling elite, the ruling caste, so to speak, they are actually the owners of the land that they rule. Because if you go to the United States, who owns the United States? Well, no one owns the United States. It's the people's property. Okay, if it belongs to the people, can I go to this park? No, you can't go there after 10 p.m. Why? It belongs to me. You just said it. Well, no, it's actually public land. It belongs to the government. Okay, who is the government? Well, it's all those people. Okay, so can they go there? You know, things like that. It's really, really complicated because there's absolutely, and I think it's made that way on purpose. But if I'm a king and I own a piece of land, there's a clear owner of the land, right? So, as a king, for example, or, you know, I can be also a republic, right? Let's say I'm not a king, I have a council. There's just a council of 10 people who are hopefully, you know, the best of the best in their particular community. You know, one is the best artisan, the other one is the best economist, the other one is the best, you know, arms dealer. Whoever they are, yeah, they own the land, and then they can create clear rules. And because you own the land, you also suddenly have a lower time preference, because you want your land to produce goods and services for you. You want to tend to your land, because you're not a president who just comes for 4 years and then leaves in 4 years and doesn't care about your land. You stay there forever, and not only forever, when you die, the land becomes your children's land, and then they have to tend to it. So because you think about the future of your land, you want to give your children more than what you had when you inherited the land. So you have to really think about things like, do I really want to piss off my population with higher taxes? Do I really want to start unnecessary wars? Do I really want to vaccinate them with stuff that they don't really need, right? Things like that. Because even if you look back in the Middle Ages, for example, there was no thing such as passports. There was no such thing as nationality. The borders were not really closed. If you didn't like your city, you didn't like Florence, you could go to Rome, and that's it. That was the end of it, right? But I, as the member of the republic, or the member of the as a king, for example, member of the royal family, I could not hold you within the walls of my city. You are free to go. So what I had to do is to think about ways of actually attracting people, not to, think of how to burden them more and more. And you attract them by creating better conditions in your own land. So when you talk about republics and kingdoms, you essentially talk about pieces of private property, kind of like malls or restaurants or anything there, that create conditions for people, that attract those people, that create conditions for them, because they treat them like clients rather than slaves. And even if, you know, mentally maybe they think of people like cattle, they still want to tend to their cattle. They still want to take care of their cattle. You know, some of the best cattle, some of the best meat comes from these agricultural, less agricultural, but more, you know, homestead type of ways of raising cattle, right? Like where shepherds really, really take care of them. It's not like the mass produced factory where everything is just a number. They actually love their cattle, and their cattle grows up really happy, and then they get the really good meat. So you kind of think about it the same way. If you're a shepherd, if you're a king, you have to think about your people as a shepherd who you know, and you tend to them. If before I thought about the word sheeple, sheep and people in a negative way, then now the way I think about it is more of a, you know, natural order thing. It's like, it, you know, it's natural that the planet is huge. There's 8 billion people out there, and clearly the vast majority of people are followers and only very few people are leaders, right? So if we talk about natural order, the, you know, the laws of the of nature and how things are, clearly most people are sheepish and other people are more like shepherds. So again, it's not to put someone down and denigrate them or anything like that. It's just a way to describe how things are. Unfortunately, these days, people don't like hearing truth because truth hurts a lot of the time, right? And today in 2020, hurt feelings are a crime. we will bring that back. I think that needs to be brought back. The natural order of things needs to be brought back, and the forced, so-called forced equality of outcome has to go, because it has no place in natural order. You cannot really manage 8 billion people. You cannot micromanage their lives. People have to have freedom of choice. And if I am a king and there's another king out there, you know, I'll do all my best to create the best conditions for the people that live on my land. And if I don't, they have a right to secede from me, to go to another guy, or create their own kingdom if they find a piece of land.
Yeah. You answered all my questions about that whole like first third of the conversation. And it was great. And what I love about it too is you kind of got into the chaos and order and how you find order through chaos, and the world does too. And so that you know, we get through kind of like how the world can look at through, we've talked about democracy and monarchy and anarchy. And sort of now we get into like hierarchy, sort of like order systems. But let's turn to the heartbeat of your work, because we are dealing with all of that. And like, you know, let's get to like citadels and citadelium, because I think this is the foundation of or your thesis of a lot of your work right now. And so what is like an inner citadel, and how does one create or build one?
Yeah, well, when I talk about citadels, it's pretty much what I talked about in terms of republics or monarchies. We just want to bring them back, right? But at the same time, going back to our conversation between the material and the spiritual part of the human being, the inner citadel has to do with the spiritual part of the human being. So that if I had to describe it in just one sentence, I would probably just quote our Jordan Peterson, who said, clean your room. And that's pretty much what it is. You really cannot go out and venture into rebuilding the world. You cannot go out into the world and say, okay, I want to change the world, before you have taken all the necessary steps and all the necessary trouble rebuilding yourself, reshaping yourself, because that's very, very important. If you think about the leader, the leader phenotype, I guess, the leader is someone who has all the best qualities that he wants to see in other people. So how does one, like before in the Middle Ages as well, right? The king who wanted to start a war, he actually went to war. He was the first one in the, you know, riding the horse and going into battle, because otherwise, who would want to fight for him if he didn't set an example, right? So that happened a lot of the time. So you have to set an example by building, by being that yourself. As a pretty known saying goes, be the change you want to see in the world. So clean your room, get your mind, get your body in shape, get your, you know, finances. I actually talked about some spheres of sovereignty that you have to really nail in your life. There are many different ways, but, and like I said, this process is going to be endless. You will probably keep doing that until you die. But it's the effort and the intention that matters, not really the end result, because you'll never be perfect. Perfection is God, essentially, so it's unattainable, right? But you can always go up little by little and achieve higher levels. So this is what I'm talking about when I say build your inner citadel. If you think about it, if you want to imagine your own way of life, if you want to imagine the what you are building inside of you, you can just imagine it as a building, or as a citadel, or as a city, right? Okay, this is my citadel, and here I have my department where I work on my thought. Here I have a department where I work on my emotion. Here I work on my anger, for example. Or here I integrate my shadow personality, as Carl Jung said, urged people to do. So you do all that work before you venture out. Do you really have to finish that work before you start doing something out in the material? Of course not. Yeah, I'm very far from perfect. I think I really have only scratched the surface with this type of work. But I'm already starting to do something outside, in the material world. But the way I think about it is that what I do in the material world is only proportional to the level of development of my inner world. So, going back to the billionaire example, you have to be ready to be a billionaire internally. You have to be essentially a billionaire internally in your spirit world to be a billionaire outside, right? If you are already a billionaire, and a billion is just a number, right? If you can just PlayStation, you have levels in some kind of game from 1 to 10. If you say, and in a billionaire means level 10, for example, if you say inside you are level 10 already, then you are ready to be a billionaire outside, right? So it all corresponds, the principle of correspondence, so to speak. And so that's exactly what I mean. Yeah, build your own personality, build your spirit first, and then go out there and show the example to everybody else. Start building something, build a following. If you are a leader, if you're not a leader, then you don't have to be. You can do your things just the way you are, on the level where you are very comfortable.
Yeah, I love that about the inner citadel. I think that's a pre-Bitcoin thing. It's kind of always working on your inner self. But let's turn a little bit to the physical world. You're building out this inner citadel, and you want maybe your physical citadel, and you want to build it, whatever that means to you, your homestead, or join a community. And you ask an interesting question, are you going to run forever? And I pondered that in a lot of different ways. And I tried to answer that for myself, even without reading the piece. And, the other one you ask is, build your citadel where you are, or find a new, better place. And I really struggled with these questions. And I'm curious your thoughts. You've lived in a lot of different places. I'm not going to ask where you are now, but I've read that, you grew up in Russia or I believe one of the republics maybe. And then you lived in Canada for a bit. So what do you think? Wherever you are, and you don't have to say, but are you where you are forever? Are you going to look for a new place? And frame that maybe how one would ask that of themselves.
Yeah, I think what's important here is that you actually settle down eventually. This concept of digital nomadism is really taking off these days. But I think it's only suitable for young people who really have no family, who are just, out there working as programmers or, web designers and things like that. Sure, go ahead and travel the world and explore and things like that. But when you start settling down mentally, meaning, I want to have one woman, I want to have children with her, I want to continue this life this way. Then you actually have to settle down physically too, because like I say, the physical manifestation of the world is just the physical world is just a manifestation of your inner world, of your spiritual world, right? So starting a family is basically a sign of you settling down in your mind, right? Because you don't jump from one relationship to another, you're settling down. So exactly the same process will have to repeat in the material world, and you will have to settle down too. I think that's very important because it's, you know, I have tried it and it's really tiring to actually travel, although it can be very exciting because you see a lot of many places, but at the same time, there has to be this type of feeling that you belong somewhere, because if you are a digital nomad, you don't belong anywhere. And at first I thought it was cool because, you know, I'm just an international citizen and, you know, all that jazz. But at the end of the day, you still have to belong somewhere. Even if it's not the place where you were born, you can still find a place where you share values with people who live there. Or you can start a new place. And that's probably where the idea for Citadels comes. Because if you can't find a place, you can find at least a community of like-minded individuals who will start a place like that with you in the future. And you can start it online first. So yeah, I have traveled quite a bit. I am in Russia right now. Will I stay here forever? I don't know. I mean, I can't say that because things change, right? I can't really predict the future. If for some reason the situation becomes unbearable here for me or for my family, then I think I will be forced to go somewhere else. And gladly, you know, I'm not really limited to this single place. And traveling the world and living in another country actually gave me the opportunity and the necessary paperwork to actually have a choice, right? But I think there's a saying in Russia, where you are born is where you are useful. So it kind of rings the bell because, okay, I'm here and I'm looking at things from a completely different perspective.
Sounds like propaganda to me.
Yeah, it is.
From some of the philosophy I've heard about, and I'm no expert on Russian philosophy, and I want to get into some things going on with Russia.
Sure.
But one thing I've heard, the notion that like the Russian entity being the government, whatever it is, I didn't mean the entity being the entity or the government or whatever the mind hive of Russia is. I've heard that the notion of power is that the citizens are kind of like the cells of the body. And so, you know, you cut the toe off if that's going to serve the body. We don't care about whatever. You serve the body versus more of like you are your own being and you're part of a thing that's separate from you. That's why it's felt very propaganda to me, because it's very useful. Like, you stay here and serve us. But I get it too. And I really struggle. One thing I don't struggle with is, you know, I'm a family man, and that is my that is part of my inner citadel. And I struggle with the physical part in terms of like, we will always be together wherever we go. But I've been a bit of a transient person. When I was younger and not, in my family yet, I did travel and live in different cities and enjoy being an international citizen and getting to see different places and kind of broadening my horizons and getting away from where I grew up. But I really struggle with, you know, like maybe we'll move every 3 years as long as we're all together, you know, because I want to go where it's best for me and for us, for my family. And you know, you wrote a piece called The World of 1,000 Kingdoms. And there's a lot to ponder there. And I do see this kind of like future world of citadels. My house is already a citadel. You know, the government might take it from me, but then we'll find another citadel. But in my mind, this is our citadel. And you know, I wonder, like, though, and I'm trying not to be emotionally attached to, you know, the United States of America as a national thing. But, you know, what do you think that the 50 states will stay together? And does that even matter? And would it be better if it was broken up in some way? And maybe that just means as a federal government light, but you got 50 independent kind of states and nations. And again, I'm not trying to get into like borders and states. I don't care about that stuff. But just, are things going to fracture? Maybe that's a positive thing, but what do you think? And what does that mean for the American project?
Yeah. I think it can fracture, but there's also two components to that. The first one can be negative and the second one can be positive. The negative one is we all know that, you know, there's a bunch of individuals in the world going under the label of globalists, I guess, who would love the states, the nation states to crumble because they want to unite the whole planet under one super state, right? Which pretty much already exists, you know, under the brand of the United Nations and that kind of, and all its auxiliary institutions, including the World Bank and things like that. But they want to, you know, further that process. I mean, it's clearly laid out in the Great Reset book by Klaus Schwab and all those Great Reset and Build Back Better kind of outlets. But the second, and that I see negative as a negative because that that includes the destruction of culture. That includes the destruction of culture, the belong, the part where you actually belong, that have a feeling of belonging, right? Because that's created by culture and tradition. That's created by your, you know, even things like ethnicity and language. That's how you have the feeling of belonging, right? You have a bunch of individuals who do exactly the same things as you do year after year, generation after generation. That's what it is. So they want to destroy that, and they just want to create a completely monotonous, family-free, culture-free society where everybody's just a cell in a body, just exactly the way you described it, right? But then there's the other side of the same coin, which also concerns the destruction of the same nation states down the road, but has something to do with what we are dealing with in terms of citadels and Bitcoin and the world under anarcho-capitalism, right? Which is essentially the breaking down of huge and unsustainable nation states into more sustainable, more manageable, you know, provinces or even city states, which is what citadels are. Because the if you read the books by Nassim Taleb, he talks about extreme localism and how the scale of a city is probably the largest scale that is manageable by a bunch of people. Anything beyond that is already unmanageable because if you imagine a city, you know where your rulers are. If you're a king in Liechtenstein is a tiny kingdom. It's literally no bigger than my town where I live, right? And you can go and drive to the king literally 10 minutes and you're there. You know where they get together. He does the crazy stuff, you kill him. That's what happens to the bad king. But in Russia or in the United States, the president is 1,000 miles away from you. You haven't met him. You don't know him. You haven't even met the governor of your state. You haven't probably even met the mayor of your city, right? So that's what I mean. And in that case, it would be positive, but at the same time, you know, it's a double-edged sword. We have to be careful about that because if we just go about it like, hey, we want the end of the state right now, let's destroy it right now, then you have to remember that the other side, the globalists, they still exist. They are still there waiting actually for it to happen to further their agenda, right? So I'm just thinking what would be a better way to do it. And I'm kind of coming to a conclusion right now that everything that we have right now in terms of how the material, you know, world is organized is what we actually deserve on a spiritual level, right? The Russians deserve to have what they have. The Americans deserve to have what they have, and the Indians deserve to have what they. You deserve your rulers. You deserve the system that you have. The system is only created by the people exactly like you. You know, there's just a few of them who are a little bit more ambitious than you, right? And that's it. And it's created by the people like you. So, you know, on a spiritual level, I guess there's there's the logos of a person, but there is also a logos of a community or a whole country. Like a whole country can be viewed as an entity, essentially, comprising of individual logi or the souls of the individuals who live there, right? Who are similar on many levels, right? They are similar individuals on many levels in terms of how they think, in terms of their collective unconscious, you know, as per Carl Jung. So obviously, when you imagine a Russian, you imagine a particular picture in your mind, right? Because that's the picture that was created, not just by, you know, anti-Russian propaganda, but just by the Russians themselves. That's how they are. Exactly the same with Americans, right? So this is what I'm talking about in terms of the soul of a whole country, right? And I think that right now, what we have in the world is exactly what people deserve, and it will take some time for people to develop, to achieve a new level in order to actually realize and kind of wake up from this sleep and understand, well, you know what, this huge piece of land called the United States of America is great, but you know, it's really, really hard to manage by a single entity called the Congress or the president. We would really love, you know, we, the great state of Texas, for example, would really love to be our own entity, and I'm sure we'll be a lot more efficient if we are just separate, right? Something like that. If people actually understand that and actually wake up to this knowing and not get activated by propaganda, right? Then I think it will happen very, very positively. It will be a good thing, and it will happen naturally. And then the state of Texas itself, when it secedes, it may break down into smaller parts, like, you know, Austin will become its own little republic or monarchy or whatever, or, you know, principality or whatever it is, and so on and so on. So I think it has to be a natural process rather than, you know, rather than something that's done by force by people who just, you know, say, okay, rise up and let's just kill all the guys and secede, you know, because you become what you fight, and you don't really achieve any higher spiritual levels when you actually take things by force. I think every little cell of that body has to wake up to this new opportunity to understand, to essentially be enlightened in a certain way, right? So I guess what I'm talking about here is more of a human and a human spiritual evolution rather than just changing things by force, by, you know, by telling people to just do it by force and, you know, without really understanding what you're doing. It's never been sustainable that way.
You know, I really feel what you're saying. And in terms of the U.S., like, let's think about it, and I'll think about it in two kind of sides of the coin. And maybe they are the same side. And then I'll leave that up to you. So, you know, let's say that the U.S. kind of fails on its own accord due to its own success just in regards to size. And the success of the central government to continue to centralize and then kind of brutalize their people and take from their people. Because, you know, I really feel that, because in terms of, and I'm not like, I'm not anti-state from birth, and it, you know, it wasn't raised by revolutionaries. But, you know, I would like more decisions to be made closer to my home so that I'm closer to that power structure so I can have more impact. I have very little impact on a national conversation and national policy. They don't even need my money anymore. So, you know, they don't listen to any of us on any core issues, and they keep providing and therefore taking more. So that's one camp, right? It's just going to fail because of its own size and success. And then, you know, there's maybe more of like internal implosion, and maybe it's not a different side of the coin, but, you know, but I'll throw the word out, like propaganda. Then I just really want to turn to Yuri Bezmenov. And you posted the video in one of your articles, and I've seen that. I've watched that video several times, and I'm not going to say anything more than that. Just, I'm going to open it to you. What do you make of that video?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that that video has something to do with the proverbial parasites that I, you know, describe in some of my work, and those are pretty much the globalists, and they have used the same tactics over and over, as I mentioned before, in terms of, you know, the animal nature of the human being. They know precisely how it works, and they use all those what they have learned over probably centuries on the public. So they have an agenda, I think. They, you know, they want to have a one world government, whatever you can call it, they are working towards it by destroying countries one by one, right? Exactly the same thing happened in Russia in 1917 when they pretty much destroyed the Russian Empire and, you know, killed the Tsar and his family. So exactly the same thing they want to do in the United States, but obviously not the same tactics work, and you can't really wrap everything in the same language, right? You can't really, you have to kind of go around it. And there's also a Chinese video about how the Chinese work and how their strategies work in terms of destabilizing foreign governments, right? And they basically say that you have to really, really understand how the local population thinks, how they work, what their cultures and culture and traditions are, how their government works, and then you have to turn their own system against them, right? So that's exactly, and Yuri Bezmenov talked about similar things, right? But he talks more about the actual implementation of the agenda, right? And he says, okay, step one, you do this, step one, you do that. But the Chinese, they talked more about the meta level of the issue, right? They said, okay, let's take the example of the United States. In the United States, there has always been this problem of, you know, racism, for example. So this is a great problem to take advantage of. We have to take it and turn it against them. We have to stir it up completely so it becomes absolutely chaotic, right? And this is where it all comes from, the BLM and stuff like that. And I'm not even American. I'm a Russian living in Russia, but, you know, I just kind of watch these things happen from where I am. To me, it's kind of clear. I may be wrong as well because, you know, again, I'm not American. I don't know everything 100%, but I also watch it with curiosity because I understand that America is pretty much the most significant player on the whole world arena, and whatever happens there ripples through the world, right? It will affect Russia. It will affect every other country in the world, especially now that Russia's ruble is essentially backed by the United States dollar, right? it has to have an effect. I think that what Yuri Bezmenov described is just part of that agenda, and I don't think he was lying or anything. He knows what he's talking about. We see a lot of the stuff that's that he described happen in the United States very, very clearly. And who are the, you know, string pullers, who is doing all that? That's probably for all of us to find out. And I think we will eventually find out. Even though I talk about the parasites, I can't really name them. I can't put a name and a face to them, right? You know, you can go to the usual suspects and, you know, say, okay, it can be like the Rothschilds or Rockefellers, but everybody knows about them, and no one really does anything about them. But maybe they are not even the ones who are doing this. They are part of them, but are they at the highest level really or not? So I don't really know, right? It's for all of us to find out. I am very sure that someone has this information. At some point, it will be released somehow. We are living in an information age. I don't think they will be able to stop the leaks forever. You know, things, you know, people talk, and now we have Bitcoin, another good part of Bitcoin, right? You place a bounty of one Bitcoin on some information, Today it's only $27,000, but tomorrow can be $270,000, or in a few years, $2.7 million. Someone will talk, and there will be a lot of rich Bitcoiners able to pay for that information, right? So I think that's how Bitcoin makes the world a little better at the same time, right? People, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners that I know, they are really, really good people. They have, you know, low time preference. They think about the future. They care about family stuff. They really want to just see, they want to make sure that the world is better for their children and their grandchildren, right? And a lot of them will be very, very rich within several years. So what do you think they're going to do when they have all that money and power, right? There will be a huge counterbalance to people who do things that Yuri Bezmenov talked about.
You know, when I watched the Yuri Bezmenov thing, I couldn't put my finger on what, I feel like he was telling the truth. But in the back of my mind, I also didn't know if he was seeding propaganda himself. And because what I come up against there is, you know, it didn't seem like things played out at home with Russia as planned. And if they could export and, you know, kind of destabilize nations abroad, you would think they'd be able to stabilize home within whatever manner they want. But maybe things went at home exactly the way they wanted it to. You know, maybe that's the other side of the coin. I don't know. And I can't help but link him to like people like Snowden and Assange, who for me are really, you know, halls of mirror, hall of mirrors. And I'm still trying to wrap my head around both those cases, and they're separate. But like Snowden, it's very interesting. Just, you know, I mean, to take your own life in your hand. We all talk about sovereignty and independence, but now he's running from the world's strongest nation. Mm-hmm. And he has to go to another nation to seek comfort. And that's, you know, an enemy of his enemy now. And he's entrusted his life in theirs, basically. You know, the same way Yuri Bezmenov, I think, had to entrust his life with Canada and probably the U.S. And you would think if they're revealing such secrets that, you know, these other entities would be able to find and deal with them. And I'm really having a hard time getting around these cases and the amount of, let's call it responsibility or just chutzpah that they take on to fight these battles, which on some levels obviously are about freedom of information. What do you think now with the dynamic between, you know, China, Russia, and the U.S.? Is Russia really a player in this trifecta, or are they really kind of more a little bit of a pawn between the two nations and kind of like trying to play the role of a bishop? Because they don't have a very big economy. They have a lot of resources, but those resources are becoming more abundant or less needed, or however you want to argue them going forward. I mean, they're still geopolitically strategic, but where do they fit in the puzzle?
I think Russia, geopolitically, Russia is important mainly because it has enough nukes to, you know, wipe out a whole planet, just like the United States does, right? So even China doesn't have this much, right? So Russia is important in terms of its military power, and not maybe the infantry. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the high-end stuff. In terms of the relationship between the United States and China, I'm not really sure. All I know is that, yes, Russia is cozying up with China simply because it's seen so much pushback from the West, right? From Europe, from the United States. Like, just read the news. There's always sanctions. So literally, they cut off the business from Russia all the time. They, you know, put all kinds of obstacles in Russians' way. For example, Russia wants to export their gas to Europe. They haven't been able to build that the pipeline for years and years because of many different things, right? So it's no wonder. You have to understand that Russia probably just really cares about Russia, right? And whoever provides better, you know, a better environment for Russia's development kind of gets Russia's friendship. And that's what I think. So if you openly confront and kind of, you know, put sticks in the wheels all the time, then it does not create really good relationship. But at the same time, I'm not here to defend the Russian government. I'm just saying that I think the United States is supposed to do what's best for the United States, and Russia is supposed to do what's best for Russia. And sometimes those interests do not they do not match, right? They are sometimes opposite. So it's no wonder. I mean, we have almost 200 countries in the world, and I think they are, while some of them are friendly, you still have to think in terms of, in the capitalistic terms, they are still all adversaries in a sense, right? They are not, they can be friends, but they still compete with each other. And competition requires requires all kinds of things to happen. So yeah, right now, you know, I'm really impartial. I'm not what you would call a you know, an avid patriot or anything like that. I chose the country because I think it has better environment for things, for low time preference things like family, culture, things like that. You know, it's a 1,000-year-old culture, and it's really family oriented. That there's no such things that happen in Canada, in the US, in terms of education and you know, the destruction of morality and kind of family values. So that really turned me off when I started a family. I didn't really care about that before, but now I do. So yeah, that really matters, and here they are trying to kind of keep it that way. And I don't know how much you can trust Putin and the government, but Putin has said it repeatedly that Russia wants to be a sovereign country, doesn't want to be affected by anybody's decision to go this or that way. Although, you know, their response to coronavirus is a bit disappointing, but not so much either, because I mean, right now I'm here and it's business as usual. Nothing is, there's no lockdowns or anything like that. And the international travel restrictions are really not on the part of Russia. It's just on the part of other countries that, you know, restricted their travel. So nothing is shut down here. Everything is proper. There's no curfews. There's no checkpoints, absolutely nothing like that. Yeah, some masks and stuff like that, but that's pretty much everywhere, I guess. They had to take to do something to look like they're doing something, right? Yeah, so as a matter of fact, I think Russia might take this as an opportunity, and while the rest of the world shuts down and kills their small business, they will try to actually prop it up, right? So not too bad if you ask me. Yeah, but like I said, I don't have a very, very strong emotional attachment. If something happens and I'm not able to stay here, I will go.
Yeah, I really want to visit specifically St. Petersburg. I'd have to touch down in Moscow as well, and anywhere else maybe you recommend or that's worth going to. I really want to go. One of the things, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Russian Ark.
No, I haven't.
It's by one of Russia's most famous filmmakers. I don't remember his name, but it's a really beautiful and, for me, moving piece where it takes place in the museum in St. Petersburg. And they actually shut the museum down, I think, for one day. I think it was Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. The filmmakers got access. And the movie is like an 80-minute one-shot piece where they go through the museum. I think it's a Russian man, maybe from the 19th century, with a Frenchman from the 18th century who's visiting Russia in present day. And they go through each room in the museum, and each room represents a period of Russian history over the last 1,000 or 2,000 years. I don't remember the exact specifics, but each room then comes alive as they move through it to kind of show the history of Russia. And then there's a dialogue between the Russian and the Frenchman about art and what Russians view as art versus what, you know, maybe more Renaissance art and French and Spanish and Italian art. And it was just a really interesting piece. One of the many reasons I'd love to visit Russia. So I'd love to turn to, you know, the knowledge universe and how, you know, one deals with kind of like, and this is something I'm really been kind of pondering. It's like, how do you deal with all the information, you know, coming at you, and how do you kind of frame up like what is information? And I think you did a great job of it. And so like, how do you look at the knowledge universe and like, what is a star and what is a constellation and a planet and how you kind of link all these things together?
Yeah. I did that a while ago when I was thinking of, how do I filter the information that comes at me from all sides? And, you know, right now I think I've already matured enough to basically figure out that what you get is usually you're bombarded with bits and pieces of information from all sides, right? And then at first, especially in the first years of your life, in the first maybe couple of decades, you really have no idea what that is, what any of this is, because nothing really makes sense. So there are almost no patterns. But then as you go through life and through experiences, you start seeing patterns and you start connecting the dots. So it's a piece of information that you did not really pay attention to, but you remembered, was not relevant before, but now it becomes relevant because you connected it with another piece of information, right? When you get these patterns and you start connecting a pattern to another pattern, you start getting these constellations of information. And then these pieces of information, like a puzzle, they basically show you a picture, right? They show you something that's more unified, and that's not completely broken down into irrelevant pieces. They are now all together like a piece of puzzle. For example, when you deliberately take a course and you want to learn about something, you know, like music, for example, you know that whatever you're learning from a textbook, you are learning about music. So you already know that all of this is filed under the category music, right? So that's clear to you, and you just know, okay, now I have to start with, you know, how the notes work, and then this, and then that, but I'm all learning about music. But there are some things in life that you don't know that they fall under a certain category, and only later you start putting them under a certain category. And that's how I started with, you know, things like spirituality, for example. I got information from all sources, and they were pieces of information from business books, even from psychology, from history, from spiritual books, and from all. And I didn't really make any connection between them. But then I also figured out that, well, wait a minute, all these sources and all these authors talk about the same thing, just in their own words. A business person just talks about the same thing, but in business terminology. And then a spiritual guy about the same thing, but in spiritual way, right? And suddenly they all started connecting, and then I got kind of a whole picture of some kind of a concept, for example. So right now, basically, the way I think about information is that it's fine to be exposed to all kinds of information first, but eventually you will have, at some point, you will have to pick a direction and go in a particular direction. And if right now you don't know which direction, that's completely fine because you simply haven't found it, right? But at some point, you will see better picture or pictures in front of you, and you will have to kind of go and dive deeper into these particular pictures. If I didn't know I was actually exposed to some spiritual material before, but now because all these patterns formed a topic of spirituality in front of me, I'm like, okay, now I'm going to study this topic of spirituality deliberately, and I'm going to pick the information that I'm exposed to instead of it being thrown at me from all kinds of sources just randomly, right? And that's how I treat information right now. I try to not basically consume randomly and mindlessly. I try to deliberately choose the direction where I go. And it's shaping up really nicely. I like it. I think I still have a lot to learn, but you know, maybe 10 years from now, I'll be very, very focused, like laser focused on some specific topics and specific directions. And that's when I probably can call myself an expert in some field, because right now I still feel like I'm a little bit here and there. You know, I'm being thrown around But it's a really interesting experience because you can see how your knowledge base is forming in front of you, right? But that requires you to be kind of awake in a certain sense, because you have to evaluate, you have to see it, right? You have to walk through life in a more awakened state. Your level of consciousness, self-consciousness, has to be at a little bit higher level, because otherwise you just go about life mindlessly. You don't notice, you act, you react to things instead of acting consciously, right? So yeah, that's my approach to information right now. I'm sure I'll learn a lot more in the future.
Yeah. You know, we touched on Bitcoin is a tool for succession, the least. But I think that we kind of like really got around a lot of the ideas. And I do recommend people go and read that piece specifically, and in all your work. That for me is a very seminal piece. It's what actually what brought this chat together. When I was prepping for Joe Rogers, I came across his curated Bitcoin words, and his September, I believe his September issue of collection of articles had that in it. That's how I came across you, through kind of Joe Rogers kind of recommending the piece. And I love that piece. And I'm going to quote from it now. So you can only change the world by changing yourself. Bitcoin may be the catalyst you were looking for. Proclaim your independence, start a family, cultivate your community, succeed. So my final question to you is, you know, because I think we touched on a lot, not everything. And I do recommend people broaden their horizon, but if they have not read your work or listened to the podcast already, but how does family and religion and God, and you could touch on those two as appropriate or not at all, but has family, religion, and God, you know, fit into rebuilding civilization?
You can basically view it on different levels, right? You start from yourself, from your personal side of things, and then you grow into the family, and then grow it in community, and then country. Mm. And basically, you have to, as I mentioned before, you have to develop, basically extrapolate. You take this same principle and you develop it within your family, right? You have to perfect all kinds of things. Then take that and expand it into your community, right? So when you talk about these levels, what is the highest level that you can? What's after the kind of the planet? Well, then you talk about the whole cosmos essentially, and the whole thing that there is. That's you have to work towards. And I think the rules of the game or the laws of nature are completely universal, right? They work both on the smallest level and they work on the highest level. And there's probably no small and high level, like it's everything is infinite, right? We can only just think about what I have to say is that there is this principle called the principle of correspondence, as above, so below, as they say, used to say in ancient times. Your inner world is called the microcosm, and the outer world is called macrocosm, right? And they are this. The other one is just reflection of what's inside of you on a macro, on the physical level, right? Not really separate. They are all one. They are connected to each other. Work on yourself when you're in a world. I literally talk about actually that the material world around you forms and changes, right? It if I think the best metaphor come across in this it's something that you can actually touch with your center body, right? Community level, country level, or whole planet. It's exactly the same work. There is no can you hear me?
Yeah, your bandwidth got really low. Maybe kill the video just because the bandwidth. It's coming through real choppy in the last 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
Will you be able to cut this? I can do it again.
Yeah, I could definitely cut it. I'll work on it. Sure. Yeah, if you want to.
Okay. Is that better now? Or
yeah,
I'm just thinking because my battery was dying. Maybe.
Okay. Yeah, I think it is better.
My battery was dying. Maybe it was time to save the battery by cutting low bandwidth or something. Okay.
Yeah.
So we can start where you stopped.
Sure. Do you want to go back to that last question, or do you want to kind of pick up a little bit into it, or do you want me to ask you a different question? It's up to you. Okay. I'll go back to the last question, and then I'll do my best with kind of the technical side of it. And I just really enjoyed this chat so far. So my last question, and to kind of regain my train of thought, was, your work talks about rebuilding civilization, a lot of it. And that's the one aspect that maybe we haven't talked about, like kind of in a little bit more depth. But the thing I wanted to lace in there specifically was family. And if you want to touch on God or religion at all and how it fits into rebuilding civilization. And if you don't want to touch on those two, but really family and what it means to rebuild civilization. Because I think we talked a lot about the tools of building a civilization for yourself. And I'll call that a citadel. Mm-hmm. And then we've talked about the tools of building that out a little bit more, where you can kind of build that into a community and then into sort of like a sort of a small anarchist minarchist state, or a world of 1,000 kingdoms, or even just live in America or Russia or China, but or anywhere in the world. But to rebuild civilization with family as the kernel of that, as I think that's a big part of your work and a little bit more of the later stages. So what does the family unit represent in the rebuilding of civilization?
Yeah, well, I think that family unit is essentially a cell in our body, in the body of our civilization, because it's one of the most important parts of it. Because if you think about it, we're all social beings. Humans are social beings, and we cannot really exist one by one individually. We always have to to form some kind of a collective. If you're just all by yourself, you are either you either live in a cave because you're just a purposeful ascetic, or you're probably an outcast and you were expelled from the community where you were in. So if we have to normally create a community around ourselves, and the first building block of that community is usually a family, because you get together with someone and you build that little cell in a community that actually lasts until you die, in the best case scenario. That cell lasts until you die. You have a spouse, but also you have something to live for with the spouse, which is your kids, and someone to give your legacy to, who can continue the work that you do. So when you take these little cells, these families, and unite them in a community, because this family they share the same language, they can share the same religion, they can share the same understanding of how things work in terms of how to do the land, how to do this, whether to go to war, not to go to war, all kinds of things that basically form the culture of that community. That's why I consider family as the most important part of any society. So when you go when you level up, in terms of a city or a country, and even the whole planet, it's all great, but at the same time, you have to understand that those higher levels are only possible because the family is there. And we talked about how, the globalists, for example, they want to get rid of the family and they want to create atomic individualism, right? Mm-hmm. Atomic individuals. I don't think that's possible, because it is the natural necessity for a human being to form a familial relationship throughout life. So The only thing, the only way they can actually achieve that is by killing that desire in a human being, by killing that desire for socializing, by killing the desire of creating a lifelong bond with someone.
Wow.
And I think, you know, the, we could, of course, go into all kinds of conspiracies here, but the way they want to do it is through material things like medication and, you know, the abolition of religion, and through lifelong indoctrination through schools and universities and all kinds of things, and just a regular propaganda on TV, obviously. That's the only way they can do it, because otherwise it is a natural human emotions, natural human inclination to create a life-lasting bond. And you normally create it by having a bond with the opposite sex, right? That's kind of the nature. It's just a natural design. It's a law of nature. The opposites, they get attracted, and that's how you create a family. It's a completely natural thing. From that stems everything else. You really can't avoid that. You can't have you cannot build a country only with guys, for example, right? There have to be women. Guys can play a certain role in that country, obviously. You know, they can be warriors, they can be hunter-gatherers, they can be whatever, but they still have to have a family with a woman who will actually then get the spoils of the war and share it, and get the, you know, whatever you brought from the hunt and cook it, right? Things like that. That's why I consider family as extremely important. And I think Bitcoin also brings this tradition back from sleep, I guess. It lowers your time preference in a way that you don't want to really spend a fortune right now, because you know it's gonna grow, right? So you want to make sure that your kids get it, and then your kids, hopefully, hopefully Bitcoin exists in that future timeline as well, they will pass it on to their kids. So they will actually spend less and less and less, because Bitcoin just keeps growing and accumulating all the value in the world. So that essentially, you remember how we talked about Bitcoin rewiring your brain and making you think in terms of a low time preference. I think part of that brain rewiring is that it makes you want to have a family. Because think about a high time preference lifestyle. What does it involve? It involves, dating chicks if you're a guy, you know, going to clubs, getting drunk, having parties and this and that. Let's contrast a family lifestyle to that, right? You're settled down, you have only one partner, you have kids, you have work that you like, probably you think about the future, how to raise your kids. It's a completely different lifestyle. It's a lower time preference lifestyle. And I think that really, really matters in this regard. So that's how Bitcoin helps you. I also wrote some articles about how Bitcoin helps family offices, but that's exactly the same topic. It talks about exactly the same thing, but you don't have to have a family office. You don't have to be a wealthy person to understand that familial relationships are something that brings meaning into your life, right? It doesn't burn your life as the high time preference lifestyle that most people go through when they are in their teens or 20s, or some people go through until they die.
Right. Yuri, I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. I'm so glad I came across your work late this year. I wish I found it earlier. You're getting into a lot of the things that I think are the forefront of my mind, and I think the biggest questions for 2021. Really kind of taking almost flag theory to a different level and combining it with Bitcoin in an interesting way. A lot of things we didn't go deep on, and we touched on a lot of your work, but there's so much more, you know, divide and rule, scientism, children of the citadel, generation Bitcoin, and what I think is really, I think you're the champion of the citadel. And that's just kind of how it bleeds into all this stuff. So, you know, where can everyone find you and your work and your awesome podcast and your blog? And please let everyone know.
Sure. My website is degaia.co. You can find me on Twitter, y_degaia. And my podcast is called Citadelium. It comes from the word citadel. And you can find it pretty much on any major platform like Spotify, YouTube, even BitChute and Anchor.fm. That's where I am.
And where Twitter? Did you give the Twitter handle?
Yes, y_degaia.
Awesome. Yuri, this has been so dope. I appreciate it so much. I can't wait to have you back. I got many more questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cedric, for inviting me, and I'm looking forward to being back.
Likewise. Talk soon. Yuri Degaia on kingdoms, monarchies, and building your inner citadel right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dug the chat with Yuri, please subscribe, like, and review my new YouTube channel and wherever you dome your pods. Those reviews are the best way to get the word out so I can keep grinding out thought-provoking conversations on Bitcoin and money. And if you're interested in sponsoring the show or just want to shoot the shit about Bitcoin, hit me up. My DMs are always open. This is Cedric. Peace.